Hello, everybody. JJ Cooper, Jacob Rutter, Jeff Ponce, Baseball America, Hot Sheet Show. Man, we got a lot to talk about today. The three of us are in a combination of buzzing and also absolutely gassed, I feel like, because I think we watched about four lifetimes of baseball in the span of one weekend with regionals and NCAA regionals going on. I think Jacob had 72 TVs set up at one point so that he could, you know, actually, I guess it would be 14 to get every game, you know, be watching. And I think he had two different ESPN accounts running at one point. But great to see everybody. Thank you for joining us on the Hot Sheet Show. As always, as we get ready, as we dive in, I want to remind you, if you have questions, ask them. Put them in the YouTube chat. We love getting to those. We've set aside time at the end of the show to get to those. We want to answer your questions, but we also want to dive into what just happened. And Jeff, I'm going to kind of hit both parts of it here, which is we just had a truly wild regionals. We have no number one UCLA, no number two Georgia Tech advancing on. But the other part of this is still feels weird to kind of even kind of process this. The resumes are done. Pencils down for UCLA shortstop Rock Chulowski, for Georgia Tech catcher Von Lackey, for UCSB, Santa Barbara right-hander Jackson Flora, for many of the top draft prospects in this class. It's over now. Kind of, has that even sunk in? And what do you think that's going to mean when it comes to a little over a month from now when we roll around to drafting?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it means a whole lot. I think that unfortunately in, you know, the two biggest showcases that college baseball has being the super regionals, right? They're better than the regionals. That's why they have the word super in front of them. But also the College World Series, not having, I think, you know, one of those three stars, UCSB was obviously always like an, you know, a long shot, a dark horse more type candidate for Omaha. But UCLA and Georgia Tech were, you know, the prime candidates that everyone picked. This could be the final. This could be, you know, the final at the College World Series. And unfortunately, we're not going to get that. We're not going to get more opportunities to see Rock Chulowski and some of the other talented players on that UCLA team. And we're unfortunately not going to get an opportunity to watch more Von Lackey, not only at the plate as a hitter, but also as a catcher. And I think if you watch Georgia Tech enough, you see just some of the little athletic things he does back there that are very peculiar and unusual for catchers. Just, you know, how quick he is out of the crouch and all that sort of thing. He's just kind of a joy to watch. And I think it's the same with Chulowski defensively. His at-bats are a little bit different. It's a little bit of a different profile as a hitter, but both guys that can leave the yard and have some impact in the bat. So unfortunately, we're not going to see that. It has definitely set in because I think we look at this field, we look at some of the mid-majors that have made it through, some of the real sleepers that have made it through to the super regionals and are now, you know, very realistic potential options for Omaha. I think that that's exciting. For me, I get excited by the Cinderella sort of stories and the teams of guys that maybe aren't full of a bunch of stars, aren't full of, you know, players with pro futures that I'm going to be watching for years to decades to come. It's these teams that only kind of have this one shot, and this is kind of their special moment. So while that's set in, while that's unfortunate, I think there's also some really good stuff to dig into here. And a lot to be excited about just from the competitive nature of what we saw in regionals. And I'm sure what will carry forward into supers.
So Jacob, this is the second straight year that we've seen the number one national seed and the number two national seed fail to advance. But it feels like it's a little different this year. Last year it was Vanderbilt, you know, number one. This year, UCLA number one is not just a number one, but a number one that was our number one ranked team all year. How stunning in this was this? And at the same time, should we be shocked by it? Or were there little inklings that maybe this could happen?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, this is college baseball. And the way that the tournament is set up does provide opportunity for these kinds of things to happen. Anybody can go beat anybody on any given weekend. And I think that that's a part of what happened to UCLA. There were signs, though. And so, you know, from a stunning standpoint, yes, because this is the record-breaking team that spent the most time atop the poll out of anybody. It's the only team in college baseball history at Baseball America to spend weeks one through the end of the regular season ranked first in the top 25. But this is a team that has kind of trailed off offensively since the start of May. They have not been hitting the same way. Rock Chalowski, for all of the criticism that he gets, had been pretty solid for the last month, not in the regional. He went, I believe, 1-for-13 throughout their regional play. They were the first team to lose their regional opener to a four seed in the super regional era, which goes back to 1999. So there was a lot that was different than how Vanderbilt lost last year. Vandy, of course, did not lose that first game of tournament play. And I think that there's a different connotation to the number one team that spent 15 consecutive weeks ranked first going home than there is to Vanderbilt, which played its way into the number one national seed because of the SEC tournament last year. So it's a stunner. I think that everybody expected UCLA to make a deeper run. This was a deep roster. You know, for all that's said about the Big Ten not being a great test, you know, these are real draft prospects, and you don't have to take our word for it. There's going to be evidence of that in July once the draft is done. So yeah, a team like that going home this early is never something that I think is taken lightly or comes as anything but a surprise.
We have the expected, I would say. We have seven SEC teams that are advancing on to super regionals. We know that because there are SEC teams playing SEC teams, we will have SEC teams in the College World Series 33rd straight year, which is a pretty remarkable number. But at the same time, Jacob, we also have a lot of teams that you don't think of. As you see here, we have three seed Troy facing four seed Little Rock in a super. We have Cal Poly in a super. We have Kansas making its first super regionals appearance ever. When you look at this big picture, are we in a little bit more of an era of parity now than we were that we thought we were a couple of years ago?
Well, certainly relative to what I think people think about college baseball, relative to the history of college baseball, I don't know that we're in the same level of parity simply because I don't think that the selection committee wants us to be in the same level of parity. We're seeing a record number of at-large bids go to power conference teams. The SEC has been in record-breaking territory pretty much since the pandemic. So since 2021, when the tournament returned, the ACC has not been too far behind the Big Ten and the Big 12, not too far behind that. Last year was the fewest bids we've ever seen go to mid-majors at the at-large level. So from a selection and tournament representation equity standpoint, no, we're not in the best era of parity ever. However, I think similar now to years past, I think there are a lot of mid-major and low-major teams that get to the tournament, and they show that the gap between the top and the middle and the bottom is maybe not as big as people perceive. And again, it goes back to the fact that I think anybody can go and beat anybody. There's a lot of talent in this sport throughout the country. It exists at multiple levels. It's the reason why 2 weeks ago on the Hot Sheet Show, we were talking about what a travesty it was that a Mercer team that won 44 games and hit the third most home runs in the country wasn't in the tournament. And I think that this was kind of the weekend that proves that they did belong. I mean, this was not a great weekend to go be a favorite. If you are a fan of Troy or a fan of St. Mary's or a fan of Cal Poly, you've seen your team compete all year, and I have a feeling that their success, while shocking to the rest of the world, to see those guys go and be scrappy and successful was not a surprise to their fans or anybody who's followed them closely. So it's a great weekend for mid-major baseball and for proof of life when it comes to parity, but it certainly exists, and my hope is that it turns into a little bit more of an equitable selection process next year.
So we've seen UCLA, Georgia Tech, and some other favorites already knocked out. Jeff, when you look ahead, when you look at who's left in super regionals, to you, is there a clear favorite remaining?
Yeah. Jacob and I had both picked on air last week, Georgia as, our potential Omaha favorite, advance and then, obviously win the championship. So I'm sticking with the Georgia Bulldogs. I still think that this is, now that Georgia Tech and UCLA have been eliminated, this is the best team remaining in the tournament. Of course, those are famous last words. We've said that about a few teams already. So who knows how this will all play out in Supers, and they don't have the easiest matchup, in Athens with SEC foe Mississippi State coming in. That's not an easy draw necessarily. Not that there's any easy draws for anybody at this point. But you know, I do think when you look at the quality of the lineup, there's enough pitching talent throughout this team. They're well managed, they're well coached. And they've kind of been a team that, as we talked about last week, has continually passed all the tests, whatever it was in front of them in big moments. You know, they've come out victorious and won. And, you know, I think you look at this sort of 3-0 run that they ran through, not that they had the toughest regional, but Liberty, you know, showed that they are a pesky team. You know, I don't think LIU was much of a matchup, but also Boston College, who was, you know, a top 25 team all year. So I think you look at Georgia, I think Georgia is the favorite. Behind them, there's still some really strong teams. You mentioned the SEC contingent. Auburn has one of the best pitching staffs in the country. Texas has been, you know, a team that was a top three team all year long. I don't know how you can look at what Kansas has done and you know, the type of performances that team put together in their regional and not think, you know, they beat Arkansas, an SEC, you know, two seed multiple times. I don't know how you can look at them and say they're not a favorite, or just sort of the fortitude that West Virginia showed last night with Kentucky in a real blow for blow kind of heavyweight bout. So I think all of those teams, and of course North Carolina, there's a lot of really good teams remaining. Yeah, I think Georgia's still the clear favorite though.
So Jacob, one other thing that is going on, even as we still have regionals going, super regionals coming up, we have the transfer portal, which we have the transfer portal tracker over at baseballamerica.com, but also we have hirings being made. We have programs who have kind of stood out, seeing their job, their coaches take steps to other programs, like a couple of notable coaching hires today that I wanted to kind of tee you up on.
Yeah, this is kind of the season where you got to keep your eye on what teams are going to be doing from a coaching standpoint. That is applicable to the head coaching position at a number of different places, although I think a lot of the biggest action that we're going to see from a firing or not renewing standpoint has already passed. Now, if there's going to be new head coaching openings, I think a lot of those will stem from coaches taking new jobs, you know, whether that's Kevin Schnall at South Carolina and Coastal Carolina opening up, whether that's Dan Fitzgerald, who's made himself into a wildly popular candidate, going and taking South Carolina or any other big job that may sneak its way open or not. That's the kind of movement that I think we're talking about here still. One thing I will point out, though, the tournament is a launching pad for finding new head coaches. Lamar just did it with Sean Allen, who had been a candidate for them for a couple of weeks. Sean Allen, the USC pitching coach, who's having a historically successful season. USC obviously now in a super regional. Lamar losing its head coach, Will Davis, who returned Lamar to the tournament for the first time since 2010, over to Houston. So success at this time of year is not just a good thing for the players. I think a lot of the coaches that are in charge of what they're doing have an opportunity to benefit and make themselves into candidates at bigger destinations. And even if it's a smaller cycle for hires, which it seems as though this year will be, I think we see some interesting movement, especially with some tournament-related names.
Okay, we are juggling many things going on at Baseball America right now. We're going to head to a break, but when we get back, we are going to talk about our updated top 100 prospects list, our rankings, which will drop tomorrow. Give you a little sneak peek here on the Hot Sheet Show. And we're back. And we have a new, every month during the season, we update the Baseball America Top 100 Prospects rankings. Now, in between that, we will move guys on for graduations and all. But every month, we try to take a step back, hit up sourcing within the game, take a look at the data, analyze everything going on, and our in-person looks as well. And we do a little bit of a re-rank. And we have one of those coming tomorrow. Obviously, we don't want to give away too much of it. It's coming tomorrow. We don't want to scoop ourselves. But I will tell you, Jesus Mede remains the number one prospect in the game. No shock there. But I would say, Jeff, that after that, we had some fun discussions about the top 10. We didn't just say, okay, well, here are the guys who's staying on because they were already in the top 10. I feel like maybe people will be a little bit surprised with how much movement we saw in the top 10. Kind of just give us a little bit of a, looking at that, are there any players from our preseason top 10 who jump out to you as like, okay, unfortunately, there's been a little bit of a disappointment for one reason or another. One I'll bring up and kind of tee you up on is, we just want to see Walker Jenkins. We love Walker Jenkins as the prospect. We're just begging for a year where Walker Jenkins does not have on his transaction list placed on injured list. This will not be that year.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's, you know, an unfortunate one. I think just for Twins fans, prospect followers, obviously Walker Jenkins himself, most importantly, because the ingredients were starting to come together. The angles have always been there with Jenkins. The bat to ball has always been pristine since he entered professional baseball. He's always had excellent swing decisions. The EVs have always been a little lacking, and I kind of wondered if that was, you know, because of the quality of his hit tool, and he's a guy that has really good angles as well, that despite being this physical, you know, really athletic body, he maybe wasn't getting to power because of the focus on sort of the hit tool, hitting things cleanly, maybe giving up a little bit of power. This year, all of those EV numbers had taken a pretty substantial jump. Now, he wasn't hitting the ball in the air consistently. There wasn't a ton of like air pull or any of those sort of metrics. But I think when you look at a player like this that has this sort of advanced hit tool and then has those EVs coming and he can run a little bit, the ingredients are there for him to have a really well-rounded hitting profile. Guy's going to hit for some average. He's going to hit for power. He's going to get on base. He's going to take extra bases because of that speed and the ability to hit the ball hard, which is going to lead fielders to make mistakes, whether it's handling the ball or even just getting overly aggressive in terms of getting the ball back into the infield. I think he has the ability to do a lot of that, plus play a premium position. Unfortunately, he can't stay on the field, and you have to wonder time and again with these injuries that as they start to sort of stack and build, does it start to break down certain parts of, you know, his game? That hasn't happened yet. He's still very young. I think there's still a lot to be excited about. He didn't move down a ton, but it was a little bit of a jump down in the top 10.
Jacob, there's another guy who's moving up. We will give this one away, and I'm going to tee you up because this is, you know, we had him on the show recently, Carson Milbrandt, Marlins right-hander. We had him on the show right when he joined the top 100. But when we do an addition in month, we just put a guy at the back of the list. And then we make sure that, okay, when we do our next reorganization of the whole list, we slot him appropriately. I will say this. We are sitting here. It is June 2nd, and Carson Milbrandt has been the best performing pitcher in the minor league so far. And I don't think there's really even that much of a debate about that, especially when you consider the level that he's been doing at, you know, primarily at Double A this year so far. Carson Milbrandt's going to be one of the big risers on it. What is he doing, and why is he climbing fast up our top 100?
Well, I'll go back all the way to last year, which is really where I think all of this starts, and that he came back 20 pounds-ish heavier and just in better shape. They were talking about how the delivery, they being the Marlins, were talking about how his delivery had become tough for him to repeat. That was a problem for him when it came to throwing strikes. And so they just got him stronger. It allowed things to be in line a lot more. It allowed the pitches to play up. It allowed the arm speed to improve. It was already good in the first place. And it got his lower half into a better position to be able to be successful. We've seen the results of that. It blossomed a lot last year. Now he's obviously exploded. So to me, that's kind of your foundation. I also think that he's really rounded into form with his trio of breaking balls. That slider has kind of a cutterish look when he wants it to, which I think has been really good for him. And the fastball has always been quality. It's a plus pitch. So there's always been multiple pitches in the tank. I think it's been a matter of whether or not he would be able to be around the zone enough with them, whether or not the delivery was going to be repeatable enough. But if he hit those check marks, there was a lot of confidence on the Marlins side, even early last season, that this would be a rise that he could make. We've seen all of those things come to fruition with a better body. And I think that now it's just kind of him realizing that. Is that better than anybody could have expected? Absolutely. I don't know that there was a single person who was going to tell you at this point last year that Carson Milbrandt would be the best minor league pitcher, you know, in baseball. But I do think that this rise was somewhat expected, and he's delivered.
So Jeff, you're pretty good at this. I'm gonna brag on you for a little, you know, for a second here. But I'm gonna put up a tweet that you had coming into the season, thing you wrote about Rays outfielder Theo Gillen coming out of 2025. You kind of laid out the question of like, hey, this is a guy who really, even though he was already on the top 100, he could really take a step forward, could really pop in 2026. Hey, we're here now. It is June 2026. And I'll give you a little sneak peek again. Theo Gillen has vaulted into that kind of top tier of prospects now. What is he doing well? And why is he one of the guys who's, again, one of the biggest risers you'll see on our upcoming top 100 update?
Yeah, and I think this is kind of like the perfect combination of tools and hitting ability or just baseball skills. You know, as you know, going into today, June 2nd, so first day of the new month, because Monday, June 1st, was a day off from the minor leagues. He's hit 313, 413, 593. All of that is sort of backed by really strong underlying data. 106.9 90th percentile EV, which is plus for a player his age and level. He's hit a ball 112 this year. It's a near 50%, 49.5%. So just under 50% hard hit rate. He makes contact. He rarely misses in the zone. It's a 19.9% chase rate with a 75% hard swing. So what that tells me is he's making a lot of contact when he swings in the zone. He rarely swings outside of the zone. And when you throw him something over the middle of the plate, Theo Gillen is hitting it and probably hitting it pretty hard. He's got speed to burn. He's going to play a premium position. I think he's one of the reasons that this Rays system, who has a lot of talented players who are green arrow up right now, he might be, you know, in the lead in terms of the guy that's made the biggest jump. And he already started from, you know, fairly rarefied air as a guy who was in the top 100 in his first professional season. Now I think we're seeing this guy really trend toward one of the elite prospects in the game. Maybe even, I don't know if he's a number one overall prospect, but potentially sort of a dark horse for that number one or number two spot, depending upon how fast Jesus Mate moves in comparison to Gillen. But this is a very exciting prospect. And I think this breakout was kind of screaming at you if you were looking at the underlying numbers coming into the year.
So I want to put out one more last call. If you have questions for us, feel free to hit us up in the YouTube chat. And we will, if you're watching live, and we will try to answer some of those when we come back from this break.
Nobody covers the prospect world and the draft world like Baseball America. And you get a little taste at baseballamerica.com. But if you would like the full menu, then get yourself a subscription to Baseball America at baseballamerica.com.
We are back, and as we always do, we like to hop in and take questions, and we have a question that is right up Jacob's alley right here. So C. Carrera 951, I believe, asked the question, UCLA, what happened? I'll add a little bit of enunciation to that one. So Jacob, you have a column. I would say if you want a full accounting of this, baseballamerica.com, Jacob had a piece up about 10 minutes after the UCLA elimination. Because you kind of, we saw this happening the day before almost, but what did happen to UCLA?
Yeah, I was going to say the reason that column was up so quickly was because we kind of were able to anticipate this. It became a matter of a very, very predictable matter for UCLA and its demise. I'll go back to what I said at the beginning of the show. I think that the offense cooled off too much for UCLA over the course of the last month or so of the season. This was not something that just appeared out of nowhere. UCLA has not been as potent, or was not as potent, as it had been for the majority of the season offensively. I think losing Logan Redmond and having to go with Wylan Moss as their Friday starter, as their game one starter in the postseason, didn't help them either to be able to lengthen and have a guy like Wylan Moss out of the bullpen, I think would have gone a long way. You imagine Wylan Moss has a chance to go and close out that last game, you know, where they get eliminated. I think that the other thing is also just that there is a luck element here. UCLA lost a quarter of all of its games, a quarter of its losses in the Westwood Regional to end the regular season. One bad weekend will be ultimately what defines this team, but it was just that. It's one bad weekend. So a combination of just slow momentum and kind of wrong place, wrong time.
Okay, next question we have is from I Will Flip You the Bird. I tried to see highlights of the Cal Poly St. Mary's game. Can you provide insight in that game? St. Mary's, incredible regional run, but Cal Poly is the one who advances. Jacob, again, I'm just going to tee you up. I know we all watch parts of that game or watch that game, but you're a college guy, so take it away.
Yeah, shameless plug of our coverage here. If you've been locked in at Baseball America throughout the year, you knew that this St. Mary's run was possibly coming. We've talked about a lot of their players and how they've been impressive throughout the regular season. That's a team that can really hit. The biggest problem for them in this last game was really that they didn't, though. They just scored two solo runs early in the game. They had a lead, and then Cal Poly took over, I believe, in the fifth and didn't go back from there. They never trailed after they took the lead in the middle of this game. Cal Poly has just had a really good weekend of pitching. It's an offense that can kind of spark quickly, mostly off of contact and good base running, not a lot of power, and that's exactly what they did in this regional, put the ball in play and put the ball over the plate when they were pitching on the mound.
Well, that is the Baseball America hot sheet for this week. By the way, there's still much coming up at baseballamerica.com. Top 100 update tomorrow. We have a mock draft coming next week. And we also have all the super regionals coverage all weekend, getting you ready for CWS in Omaha and all the draft coverage with that as well. For Jeff, for Jacob, I'm JJ. Check out all the other coverage at baseballamerica.com. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel and also subscribe to our podcast feed. So much great content. We hope you enjoy all of it. So long, everybody.